Well, Machik's thought is very, very complex. And after preparing for this class, I recognized why I refused for so many years to teach it. I've been busy really the last 4 or 5 days, all day, every day, just reading things that I thought I read and I knew already 10 years ago. And it's very difficult, as we'll see. I'm going to start by first, as you see, the first section has outlined, to go over who Rabbi Soloveitchik was. Everything that I have gone through, I decided to put in here for you as well. If you turn already to page 1, where they have a circle there on the left side with nothing in it, it should say Soloveitchik family. This is from the Encyclopedia Judaica. This is just to give you some background here to understand who this man is, because before you can go ahead and proceed and appreciate his thought, I think you have to know who he is. First of all, the Soloveitchik family, I would say, is probably the most renowned rabbinic dynasty, perhaps with the other family being the Schneerson family, the Lubavitch family. That is, however, ended, as you know, with the death of the Lubavitch Rebbe. Rabbi Soloveitchik still has children, his sons-in-law, who will continue on after him. There's a Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, who I still ask questions to now in Chicago. The Soloveitchik dynasty, as you see at the bottom there with that family tree, goes way back. Really where it starts significantly with reference to Jewish scholarship as we know it is if you look at number 6, kind of in the middle. Number 6, you see that? Joseph Baer, 1820-1892, was known as the Beit HaLevi, which really means the House of Levi. The Soloveitchik family are Levites. They're from the Levite tribe. Rabbi Soloveitchik himself always used to joke that he's from the Levite tribe whose job it was to sing in the temple. His name, Soloveitchik, means a nightingale, and yet he can't sing. That's what he would always say. Rabbi Soloveitchik's dynasty, as we know in terms of scholarship, goes back to the person who he was named for, his great-grandfather, there, number 6, Joseph Baer, Yosef Dov in Hebrew. Yosef Dov, Joseph Baer Soloveitchik, number 6, if you have it listed there from 1820-1892, was a rabbinic figure who taught in the Volozhin Yeshiva. I recognize some of you are familiar with these terms, some of you are not. The Volozhin Yeshiva, I don't think we recognize it, all of us, but throughout Jewish history, there weren't necessarily large yeshivas where people studied. There were Talmudic times, and then there were smaller types of places people would study. The Volozhin Yeshiva was, if you will, the Harvard of the yeshivas, if one can say such a thing. The Harvard of the yeshivas in the 19th century. The Volozhin Yeshiva was headed by the famous Rav Chaim of Volozhin, if you ever heard the name, who was the primary student of the Vilna HaGaon, the great genius of Vilna, or Eliyahu Vilna HaGaon. Many of you know him from, I've mentioned him many times in the past, was known as Vilna HaGaon, knew the entire Torah, not forwards by heart, but backwards. People testified he could say Ashrei backwards, a strange thing, but he could say every word backwards. The Vilna HaGaon studied 22 hours a day, his children testified to that fact, with his feet in water at night, in cold water. He slept 2 hours, but he woke up every half an hour or so to go ahead and continue studying. The Vilna Gaon in his sleep, his children testify, studied Torah in his sleep. You know, you and I sleepwalk and say whatever we want. Although once my kids told me, I said my modernity's over in my sleep. But basically, the Vilna Gaon was someone who was very unique. He gave a command, as a famous story goes, to Rav Chaim of Volozhin, his top student, to build a yeshiva, to go ahead and to train the rabbis for the Jewish people. And the Volozhin Yeshiva was, I say, the Harvard Yeshivas attracted not only religious students, but even, as it were, people who were, if you will, from the enlightened Haskalah, from the more secular side, perhaps, of Judaism as well, or people who were in the mode of criticizing Judaism at the time. They were drawn to the Volozhin Yeshiva by the incredible academics and intellectual fervor that was a part of that institution. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the great-grandfather of Rav Soloveitchik, taught in that institution. His son was known as you see here, number 9, Chaim Brisker Soloveitchik, known as Rav Chaim Brisker. In the yeshiva world, Rav Chaim Brisker is an absolute legend. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, as we'll see in a little bit perhaps, kind of revitalized Talmudic learning with heavy analysis and the ability to go ahead and determine and make distinctions between halachas very carefully. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik wrote very little, but he was known as the great genius of his day. That was from Soloveitchik's grandfather. His father was Moses Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, number 12. That was his father, who also was a great genius in Torah. Not as well known as Rav Chaim, but a great genius. You see number 15, Rav Soloveitchik's uncle, Rav Isaac Zeev, known as Rav Velvel of Brisker, who became a great Rav in Eretz Yisrael. Incredible genius. I mean, you're talking about, in Talmudic terms, all these people are like Einsteins. And Rav Soloveitchik is from this stock. I'm just trying to point out that some people are kind of born, you know, into this type of intellectual environment. And Rav Soloveitchik certainly was. You finally see him in number 16, Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, born in 1903. He died in 1993. And that takes us up to that personality. You'll see here, you can look on your own later, Soloveitchik name here. This is from the Encyclopedia Judaica. On the right, you see Aaron Soloveitchik, who I said is still alive in Chicago. Turn the page. You have a whole discussion of Chaim Soloveitchik. I just thought this might help you appreciate who this family is. You have, to the right, Soloveitchik, Isaac Zeev Halevi, known as Rav Velvel of Brisker. All these people are legends in the Talmudic halachic world. Finally, you get to the next page. You have Rav Yosef Ber of Volozhin, who I discussed earlier. And then on the right, you have Rabbi Soloveitchik himself, who we're studying, Rav Yosef Ber of Halevi Soloveitchik, 1903 to 1993, died at age 90. I'm going to do something a little strange. I'm going to read through it. I would think this would be the most boring of classes this week. After that, I think it'll be more exciting. But the first week, it'll be a little slow. I'm going to do a little reading here of this Encyclopedia Judaica article. There's some other good articles as well on biographies of Rav Soloveitchik, but I have to think this was sufficient. U.S. Talmud, if you have it, U.S. Talmud scholar and religious philosopher, Nasean of a preeminent Lithuanian rabbinical family, C. Soloveitchik, who did. Soloveitchik was born in Prusin, Poland, where his maternal grandfather, Eliyahu Feinstein, was the rabbi. So you see, by the way, not only on his father's side, which is Elmer Soloveitchik, but even on his mother's side, he came from rabbinic stock. And by the way, the name Feinstein is no accident. He was a cousin of Rav Moshe Feinstein. So you realize what we're talking about here? We're talking about like taking Einstein and Newton, you know, 10 times over, putting them together. And it's no surprise, you know, something's going to come out of this. So this is who he was. Soloveitchik spent his early years in Halavis, Belorussia. Interesting, I'll just give you these facts, I think they're fascinating, although it's not our major concern. In Halavis, Rav Soloveitchik's father sent him to study Talmud with a Lubavitcher Chassid. A test after a year or so on Talmud, this is when he was about 6 years old. And he didn't know any Talmud, but he knew the Tanya, which is the primary Lubavitch text. In other words, the teacher had not been teaching in Talmud at all, but Lubavitch Chassidus. His father was furious, and that's it. He decided from then on, he's going to learn with him one-on-one. Okay? But to this day, by the way, the Soloveitchik still quotes, he always had a little love of Lubavitch Chassidus. And that's why, by the way, where no great figure of our age really went to 770 Eastern Parkway to see the Rebbe, but Soloveitchik, when Lubavitcher Rebbe was celebrating one of his anniversaries, actually went to 770 Eastern Park, this beautiful picture of Soloveitchik with Lubavitcher Rebbe. It was an incredible meeting of minds and of spirit. But nonetheless, Soloveitchik from his youth remembered Hasidic texts and was involved somewhat with a positive attitude toward Lubavitch. Now, as it says, so this Lubavitcher Hasid was not teaching correctly. Moshe Soloveitchik took it upon himself to learn with his son. And he learned with his son for 12 years. Now again, you have to understand what this means. Imagine this guy who's already an incredible mind, he's going to learn for 12 years. He didn't go to school. Whatever the rules were there, you know, it wasn't like it is in America today. He learned with his father for 12 years straight. And believe me, there was no recess. That's what they said. There was no recess. It was known that he wanted to not play. His father would say, no time to play. He'd play later, you know. Basically, it was 12 years of solid scholarship with his father. If anyone knows anything about the study of Talmud, Rav Soloveitchik finished. I remember seeing today in an article written some years ago that he finished in those 12 years about 24 Talmudic tractates. And I'm talking about difficult tractates. 12 years with his father, he was already, in other words, by the age of 17, 18, he had learned basically the entire Talmud. And I don't mean learn it like I learned it. I mean he mastered it. And I don't mean mastered it like I would master anything. I mean mastered it with a full vision of clarity and understanding and this relating to that and all sorts of new ideas. He was told by his father to start writing down his chidushim, what we say his new ideas, in the Talmud, his own explanations. When he was already about 12 years old, he started writing his own ideas down in notebooks. There's a famous case, it's unbelievable, where there's a famous dispute about how to blow the shofarim, the three, the three-note voice of the shofar that we blow. Famous dispute based on Rashi and the Tosafot in the Talmud. And it's interesting, a few years ago, Rav Herschel Schechter, who was a great rabbi in New York, listed customs of the Soloveitchik family. They have a special custom how they blow that note. When he listed that, Sir Schechter said, in his notes, he said, and the way, of course, we blow the Shvarim, everyone knows, is like Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said, Schechter showed this to Aaron Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik's brother, to see if there were any mistakes. He said, yeah, there's a mistake. The way we blow shofar is not like my grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik himself, Rav Yosef Er Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik we're discussing, when he was 12 years old, came up with an answer to go ahead and come up with a solution to a famous debate between Rashi and Tosafot. When he was 12, sent this to his grandfather, who was the leading rabbi of the generation, and his grandfather accepted it and said, oh, this is the answer. From now on, we're going to blow like my grandson, 12-year-old Rabbi Soloveitchik. So I'm telling you, this is like, Yitzchak Perlman, or people like that. Protégés, so you just can't imagine. You have to understand who these individuals are. So Rabbi Soloveitchik had 12 years of study, like, I'm telling you, it was like Einstein, just 12 years, just in and out. But Chavrusa, he was a study partner, his father. An incredible thing. He goes on to say, and I'll correct this if I disagree with it or ask next time, he said, under his father's tutelage, he mastered his grandfather's Chaim Soloveitchik method of Talmudic study with its insistence of incisive analysis, exact classification, critical independence, and emphasis on Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. We'll see this somewhat later, maybe. In his late teens, Soloveitchik received the equivalent of high school education from private tutors. At the age of 22, he entered the University of Berlin. Now, it says he majored in philosophy and was attracted to the Neo-Kantian school. In 1931, he received his doctorate for his dissertation on Hermann Cohen's Epistemology and Metaphysics. Hermann Cohen was a famous classical, some might consider reformed Jewish thinker, who put a great emphasis on reason. He was a very big name at the time. And Rav Soloveitchik originally wanted to do his PhD on Maimonides and Plato, but at the University of Berlin, which was the top university in the world at the time, certainly philosophy, felt they had no one who was capable of overseeing his topics. They said. So instead he did it on Hermann Cohen. Now, I got to tell you, boy, it kind of cuts to the quick here, because I wish I would know clearly what happened to Rabbi Soloveitchik in Berlin. Anyone who would write an intellectual biography of Rabbi Soloveitchik would want to know this, because as we'll see in a few moments, it would seem that something hit him when he went into Berlin and studied philosophy in Berlin. Let me tell you, by the way, there were other people in Berlin at the time as well. The Lubavitcher Rebbe at the time was studying in the same class with Rabbi Soloveitchik, as well as Nechama Leibowitz, the famous biblical scholars, and others as well, I forget right now, but those three for sure were in the same class. Because when I had Nechama Leibowitz in Israel for the study of Torah some years ago, I remember she told us that here was the difference between Rabbi Soloveitchik and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. She said both got an A+. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe just stood there the whole time and just learned Torah, and he got an A+. Rav Soloveitchik, because he was into philosophy, really participated, paid attention, he got an A+. But they both got an A+. I imagine she got an A+, too. in any event, it's an amazing thing. The people you had in this class, Berlin at the time, was an incredible gathering of intellectuals. People would be seen on the streets, doctors, philosophers, rabbis, geniuses. Really incredible minds walking the streets. This book, by the way, not a famous book, there's a book by Hillel Goldberg called something like From Slobodka to Berlin, which is an interesting, fascinating analysis of these great rabbis and Talmudic individuals who went from traditional backgrounds to Berlin and what happened to them. For example, Harry Wolfson from Harvard, great philosopher, He also was raised with a Talmudic background and everything, which seems to even carry over his philosophy. This guy Goldberg writes about it. There's some things he said about Rabbi Soloveitchik I don't like very much, but in any event, it's a fascinating work, really. It'll keep your mind in it. Rabbi Soloveitchik discussed a whole other host of philosophers. Okay, so he was at Berlin. I don't know what happened at Berlin, because we'll see later, something happened, I believe. He majored in philosophy, but they don't discuss really what his major calling was. We'll see this in a few moments. In 1931, he received a doctorate. He said, that same year he married Tanya Lewitt, died in 1967, herself a recipient of a doctorate in education from Jena University. Waverly assisted him in all his endeavors. Now, already, the idea that Rabbi Soloveitchik here has a PhD in secular studies, I mean, in philosophy, you have to know, was not the norm, first of all, in Eastern Europe, for sure. It may have been in Germany. In Germany, where you had the influence of Rabbi Shimshon Perl Hirsch, who could study him in another class for 7 weeks one summer, who was the great leader in Germany and expositor of the view of Torah in Derech Eretz. There should be Torah with secular studies. That was the role in Germany, that was the case. But in Eastern Europe, it's kind of like today, you have the same battle, we'll see later on as the weeks go by. In Eastern Europe, secular studies was not only frowned upon, it was seen as forbidden, it was seen as it would ruin your chance at a shidduch. Remember that today. If you got a secular education, it was seen as being something that was improper, that would take you away from Judaism. Rabbi Soloveitchik going to get this PhD at Berlin, I mean, this is big stuff. I mean, Soloveitchik did not do this. He was going against everything his family stood for. He explained later that the reason this happened was because of his mother. His father was straight, just like his grandfather, straight Talmud Torah, everything else. That's it. His mother had read a great deal of literature, Ibsen and others, when she was young, and she loved literature. So like when he had breaks from studying Talmud, his mother would discuss literature with him. So he began to read literature, he got involved in philosophy, and then he decided, at her, in a sense, request, to go for this PhD at the University of Berlin. It's just a fascinating kind of broke, not kind of. He broke from a family tradition, and to this day, or to the day he died, I would say probably most of his family did not speak to him. A huge rift. Rabbi Soloveitchik, you have to understand as we go on, is a greatly controversial figure. I know when you hear me quote him, you think, well, Rabbi Orthodox is quite a great Orthodox figure. Even in the Orthodox world, we will see as we go on, Rabbi Soloveitchik is a great controversial figure. So he gets his PhD at Berlin, gets something unheard of for the Soloveitchik. By the way, his younger brother, as I tell you, I still ask my questions too, but Aaron Soloveitchik followed the same route, because he got his mother too, because he has a law degree from the University of Chicago. He gave a whole series of lectures that I have on tape about the relevance and importance of secular studies in Torah, and how one should study secular studies. So he and his brother kind of went the same route, but especially, if I told you, remember of Moshe Soloveitchik, his father, went to Yeshiva University after they came from Europe. His brother, I said, Rav Belbulo Soloveitchik, look back at one point. He went to Israel, and in Israel, where the Soloveitchik dynasty continued to grow, no secular studies, nothing. In fact, they're known kind of as the extreme in Israel, totally anti-secular studies. The Brisker dynasty in Israel, totally different from the Soloveitchik approach in the United States. And these are families who really did not, you know, talk, because this is not little stuff. This is not like you didn't invite me to your bar mitzvah party. This is, you know, the Dara and Torah, the way in Torah of my ancestors was only Torah. We don't go and study secular, get PhDs and spend years and years studying secular stuff. We don't do that. That's not our family tradition. And Russell Mason, to take that move, absolutely was a huge rift in terms of where his family always was at. But obviously he felt he had to take it, and we'll see why. I'm still reading here. In 1932, they emigrated to the United States. Now, a few months after his arrival, Soloveitchik became rabbi of the Orthodox Jewish community of Boston, the city which remained his home. Rabbi Soloveitchik became the chief rabbi of Boston when he was all of 29 years old. That means 29 years old, he was the chief rabbi of Boston. Boston is not even Cincinnati. Even though Boston had many more Jews today, as you know, it's a big community, Boston. 100,000 Jews in Boston.
Did you say chief rabbi? I didn't know there were chief rabbis in the U.S. Chief rabbi.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rabbi Silver was the chief rabbi of Cincinnati. You know the famous story of Rabbi Silver? Some of you have heard it. That after the war, Rabbi Silver did great things to save Jews. He went to visit people in in the DP camps, and he was introduced. And they said, when introduced, the chief rabbi of the United States, Rabbi Eliezer Silver. Now, what do you want, right? He goes, chief rabbi of the United States and Canada. What can I tell you? He was the chief rabbi of Boston until his death. Now, there's nothing went without his okay in Boston. Interesting, by the way, just to show that the trouble, even a person like that, is before he became, or when he became chief rabbi, he also was appointed the head of a synagogue. And came Rosh Hashanah. This is related to Hershel Shenker's book, for those of us giving sources. It's a book called Nefesh HaRav, the Soul of Rabbi Soloveitchik, which he wrote after Soloveitchik died. And in that book, he says that Soloveitchik had a job outside of Boston, and for Rosh Hashanah, it was Shabbos, and it was Rosh Hashanah. And so I don't know if you're all familiar with this, but you know the Kohanim Duchen, right? The Kohanim gives the Birkat Kohanim, the special blessing they give, right, in traditional shuls. So there became a custom for some reason, people don't understand really that on. If Yantiv, the holiday comes on Shabbos, the Kohanim don't give that blessing. They don't give that blessing. Okay? It's a mistake. Everyone says it's a mistake, but it's defined in some rare sources. Rabbi Soloveitchik saw that people weren't going to go up and give the blessing, so he went up to the Kohanim and said, go do the Birkat Kohanim. They said, our custom is not to do it. He goes, it's a mistake. You have to do it. He made him do it, and like the Monday after Rosh Hashanah, he was fired. They fired Rabbi Soloveitchik. So whenever like, I get into that situation, trouble, you know, I think of Moses who was stoned, you know, or Soloveitchik who was fired, really, because it's an incredible thing, he was fired. And thank God he was. So he saw it wasn't for him to be a synagogue rabbi, and he went on, and then he became the chief rabbi of Boston. And this is in the 1930s. You see what he was. Again, if you continue, it says a few months after he became chief rabbi, etc. He then founded the first Jewish day school in New England, the Maimonides School. Wouldn't you know, what do you call it? The Maimonides School. Okay? Means something. And also conducted postgraduate Talmudic classes for young scholars who gathered around him. Now, we will discuss, as we see later when we get to secular studies and women's education, what type of things were instituted by Rabbi Soloveitchik in the Maimonides School, which again were very controversial, but kind of show clearly where he stood on these issues. At least you would think it would show it clearly. We'll have to see. With the influx of European yeshiva students during the late 1930s, this advanced Talmudic Institute was organized on a more formal basis, the Hechor Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi, Yeshiva Torah of Israel. So he named this great institute after his grandfather. However, this new school was disbanded in 1941 when Soloveitchik succeeded his father as professor of Talmud at the Rabbi Isaac Elkanah Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University. That's where I attended, that's where many rabbis attended. So this institution, Rabbi Soloveitchik was the Rosh Yeshiva succeeding his father who died in 1941. Now, it's interesting, Rabbi Soloveitchik continued to live in Boston. You think he got this job in New York? All right, you know, it's not like he can hop across the date or something. You know? So he goes ahead and he stays in Boston. He decides to stay in Boston, and he flies down for the next 45 years of his life until he's in his mid-80s. He flies from Boston every Monday, I believe it was, Monday, Tuesday, and he stayed in New York Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, whatever, 3 days, giving classes to hundreds and hundreds of students, lectures that sometimes lasted not just 2 hours, some say 5-6 hours. In fact, there was a famous lecture he gave called the famous Thanksgiving lecture, because he was giving, it was Thanksgiving, and he observed Thanksgiving. Many other great rabbis didn't. Again, it shows where he is. He observed Thanksgiving at his home in Boston. And so it was like time to go get the plane. And so someone sent up a note, like his Meshavish, the person like who helped him along. And the note said, you know, Rebbe, what, you got to go. You got to be Thanksgiving in Boston, you know. You're going overtime. So they were in the midst of a very difficult Tosafot. It's a difficult commentary, right, Rashi's children on the Gemara. Very difficult. And he says, no one leaves this room till we understand this Tosafot. So even though he kept Thanksgiving, it's not like you think, oh yeah, he took off with the Macy's, you know, enjoyed himself. I mean, you have to understand, even when he was keeping these cultural things that he felt they were important to keep, he was absolutely dedicated to the study of Talmud. We're here for 5 hours, almost leaving, we finished, then we'll go eat the turkey. We're going to do this now, okay? It's very critical to understand this. So I told Macy's would give Shurim up to 5 hours, they said. 5 hours, he managed to sing a lecture for 5 hours, and no one blinked, no one said a word. You know, he came into class, and he was like, he was fired. You know, he was done. And, you know, you had to know your stuff. I'm only doing this stuff for the first week to give you a feeling who this man was. Again, like he'd be in class, And he'd say, so-and-so, you know, what does Rashi say on this? Close your books. What does Rashi say on this? The guy would say, Rashi, go wrong, get out. He'd go like this, right? Then he finally said, what does Rashi say? He goes, Rebbe, Rashi doesn't say anything on this. He goes, that's right. I mean, you know, he was just, to show you that, again, the belief he had, this was an amazing element of him. The notion of truth and honesty. Once he was saying something, he asked her a question, how do you explain this Talmudic debate? So someone raised his hand, and he gave this whole beautiful explanation. And her Soloveitchik said, that's wrong, it's no good. It's no good, let's go on. They said, Rebbe, he said, what do you want? He goes, but you gave this explanation last year. You gave this explanation. He goes, so what? Don't plagiarize me. He says, that I said it 2 years ago doesn't mean it's right. So now I see it more clearly and it's wrong. But most people wouldn't do that, seriously. Most people, if you think a guy, say, wrote a thesis, wrote a paper, to then go back and decide it was wrong. But he says it's in class all the time. If he thought, I said something a few years ago, I rethought it's wrong. That's it. He wanted people to think for themselves. Just don't regurgitate what I said. Now, again, to show he knew who he was, I mean, everyone knew he was a very humble person, but he was a strong person. Again, someone once in class said something, he was saying something, and he was saying something over, and someone said, but Rebbe, what do you want? He says, but the Vilna Gaon says this. And so Vilna Gaon means the Vilna genius. Gaon means genius, right? The Vilna Gaon says this. He goes, I'm also a Gaon, okay? I'm also a genius. Don't give me that. I'm also a genius. I can say what I want to say. Then the guy said, but Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon agrees with you. Then he said, oh, now you see I'm right. So, in any event, he had a sense of humor, this man. He was an incredible figure. My Rebbe, Rav Parnas, one of my teachers, told me that Rav Soloveitchik in Boston, it was known, this was his day. After going to shul, he came back to his room. He then ate breakfast, read the newspaper, which not all people read newspaper in Orthodox circles. I hate to tell you, there's a lot of gossip. People don't read the newspapers. I can tell you stories about that, but in any event, Rabbi Soloveitchik read the newspaper, then went to his room in Boston, locked the door, and stayed in there for 10 to 12 hours. Well, if he ate lunch or not, or had lunch brought to him, I did not come out for 10 to 12 hours straight studying Talmud. And again, it's not me and you studying Talmud. We're talking about a mind here, and it's not studying Talmud on a basic level, okay? We're talking about deep, deep thought. I mean, this is how this man grew. And he had incredible, what we call hatmada, hasmada, incredible, what's the translation? Perseverance, that's good. I mean, you know, there are two tricks when it comes to being a great scholar. One is you have to have a great mind. I mean, you do. Number two is you have to devote yourself to it. You know, there are plenty of great minds who just go wasted. So, be it in music or anything, right? You can have talent, but you don't do anything. Soloveitchik was someone who persevered. He kept improving himself, kept growing, growing. It was an incredible thing. We could all do that and come to our potential like he did. It would be absolutely amazing. But he did that. He was known for that. Okay, he goes on to say, Cambridge University. Also, for many years, he lectured at the University of Bernard Rebel Graduate School, where he served as professor of Jewish philosophy. Again, I can't help but emphasize that you have no Talmudic scholars in our time, do you? We can, maybe a few in Germany, who were Talmudic scholars known as halachists and also professors of philosophy. And again, you had Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg in Germany, who was also known as at the Berliner like seminary. They had certain individuals like this, Dr. Rabbi Chaim Heller, a few people. But in traditional circles, generally, in Rosh Hashiva, that's it. Rav Moshe Feinstein did not have a PhD in philosophy. You know what I'm saying? Rav Kook, who did write some philosophy, but totally different than Rabbi Soloveitchik. First of all, he wasn't at a university. This is different. Rabbi Soloveitchik is teaching not just Jewish philosophers, non-Jewish philosophers. And he's giving lectures at Harvard and Rutgers. He's giving lectures. You can imagine Rav Moshe Feinstein walking into Yale, you know, and giving a lecture on, you know, philosophy. I mean, this was Rabbi Soloveitchik was doing this. He was clearly in both worlds. I should say, I think he was clearly in both worlds. You're going to see this debate, just like the debate about Maimonides, there's going to be debates about Rabbi Soloveitchik as well. So he's giving these philosophy classes as well, along with his Talmud classes. All I can tell you is people who were there, I mean, it's an amazing thing. It says here as well, you see that these positions, Soloveitchik became the spiritual mentor of the majority of American-trained Orthodox rabbis, and for decades inspired students to follow his teachings. He was a legend at the time, Yeshiva University. Now, people called him, some of you know this, They called him the Rub. I say the Rub, not the Rab, because in Ashkenazi Hebrew they pronounce it the Rub, which means the Rabbi. There aren't a lot of people you call the Rub. The Vilna Gaon was called the Gaon. You never say the Vilna Gaon, it was called the Gaon. Like there are a lot of Rebbes, you know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, something the Rebbe. You know what you're talking about. The Rub. He was called the Rabbi, the Rub. Why he was called that, I got the name. Kim sees different views on that, but simply speaking, he was seen as, you know, the authority par excellence, the Rub. He called himself a Malamed. A Malamed means just a teacher. It really is. A Malamed is someone who teaches kids. He was a Malamed, an incredible teacher, incredible clarity in his teaching. You know, there are people who are geniuses who can't teach. You probably have teachers like that. You've had teachers in college, whatever, who are brilliant, but like they couldn't teach. And he's an incredible teacher. He was an incredible darshan, which means every year at the yard site, the day of the death of his father, this became like a gathering for all of world, all of American Jewry. 1,000 people would gather at Yeshiva University. All from the East Coast, especially people would come to hear him speak about something new in the Chumash, in the Bible, with his own unique explanations. I mean, I could write probably, you know, just get a Chumash and write his explanation throughout the Torah. It was just amazing. Every year he did this. He turned this out. Men and women would attend. He was an incredible darshan. He was also, although not so much, he became a posek, maybe against his will. A posek means a halachic authority. Really against his will. See, Rav Moshe Feinstein was a posek. He was a halachic authority. People from the world over asked him halachic questions. Rav Soloveitchik did not really want to determine the outcome of halachic questions for various reasons. Among them is that the Soloveitchik methodology kind of was, you develop each view, let's say you had a dispute between Maimonides and Rashi, you develop each view to like such a pristine point that it's very difficult to go ahead and decide really which one you should follow. And then you might follow certain rules, but we don't know. Since he kind of felt he did not want to do that, but he ended up doing it against his will when American Jewry at the time, especially so-called modern Orthodoxy, went ahead and recognized him as the one who would make decisions, as we'll see, about, for example, ecumenicism. Should Jews debate Christians? Should Jews sit down with Christians and talk about shared spiritual language and their books that they share and their feelings and things like that and their religious rituals? We'll see. And generally what he said became the mode of practice for all of what's called modern Orthodox Jew. At the time, maybe even for so-called Aguda or white right. In 1952, Soloveitchik, getting to this, also exerted a decisive influence on Orthodoxy in his capacity as chairman of the Halakhic Commission of the Rabbinical Council of America. We point that out. He also identified himself as religious Zionist of America, Mizrahi, and has been the organization's honorary president since 1946. This is still alive. This is going to be another huge falling out that Rabbi Soloveitchik has with his family. His family was staunchly anti-Zionist. The Brisker dynasty was anti-Zionist. We will see in a few weeks Rabbi Soloveitchik, to look at him carefully, but he became the head of Mizrahi, which is the religious Zionist of America. Right? He became the head of the religious Zionist of the world. Okay? So he saw something in the state of Israel that others in his family did not, and many others in the family of halachic scholars did not. You have to realize, again, all these things, I'm telling you, are alienating Rabbi Soloveitchik from many of the Talmudic scholars of the world. He's kind of walking his own way. Following the death of Chief Rabbi Isaac Herzog in 1959, Soloveitchik declined to be a candidate to succeed him as Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of Israel. He was asked to be Chief Rabbi in 1936 or so of Tel Aviv. Interestingly, he lost because Rabbi Meir Berlin, his cousin, said that he was not pro-State of Israel. Because at the time, Rabbi Soloveitchik, like others, was a member of the Aguda of the more so-called Black Hat Yeshiva party, which has a more negative view toward the land of Israel, toward the state of Israel. So he was a member of the Aguda, so his own cousin told him to pick up Amiel, who became the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, instead of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Paragraph Soloveitchik was looked up to North America as the unchallenged leader of enlightened Orthodoxy, and was possibly known simply as the Rub, he said. His main influence was through the lectures and public discourse. It's very important. Now, Slovacek wrote very little. Does it say here why?
Demands of perfectionism.
Right, demands of perfectionism. So the basic, especially when I was being like a teenager, 20s, there was nothing written for me. The essay, Halakhic Man, which we're going to look at, right? It was an essay, it wasn't a book. It was written in Talpia, the Hebrew magazine. And it was written in 1944. And it was not translated, so whatever this is, 1980.
Yeah.
1983. You remember, for 39 years, no one in the English world, no one existed. The Lonely Man of Faith, he didn't write until 1965. I mean, here's a man, as chief rabbi of Boston, age 29. He's already got everything. He's already giving classes and lectures, the highest level of anyone in America. He's not producing anything. And it was the family custom not to produce. His great-grandfather, Beis HaLevi, he said, was named for, only wrote really a small volume on Flemish and one large volume on Responsa. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik really didn't write anything. It's only his students who went ahead and compiled what he wrote. And by the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik, the same thing. There's a book he wrote called Ala Tshuva, on repentance. Another famous work. We're not going to be reading that. But Ala Tshuva was, in fact, also just compilations of his lectures. He didn't write it. Most of his teaching was done through oral discourse, through the lectures at Yeshiva University, from going to synagogues and lecturing. I mean, these things were not like your typical little lecture where you take them and melt them, you know, like you take, this became a classic thing. He does have tapes, by the way, so you know there's some controversy about the tapes, but he has tapes about hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands, that you can get. He would not necessarily understand it totally. He has somewhat of an accent when he discusses Hebrew. But when he speaks Hebrew, but very fascinating tapes. Maybe the last session will play something. I don't remember what you told us. Yeah, there was some question about things being stolen. I don't know.
If he didn't write books,
yes.
How come his influence was so great?
That's a good question, because traditionally, Jewish scholars influence people by their presence and by their oral teachings, not necessarily by their writing. I'll give you an example. The Vilna Hagaon, one of the most influential Talmudic scholars, right, the past few centuries, really didn't write anything. In Shulchan Aruch, I shouldn't say, he has little glosses, little tiny notes. Not like Maimonides, you know, wrote a guide for the perplex for philosophical-minded people and wrote the Mishnah Torah for people in the halakhic world, you know. Just that was not necessarily how it was done. True, so we had Rashi and others who commented, but it wasn't necessarily the case that to be, for example, Moshe Feinstein, he would have been Moshe Feinstein, the same influence, even if he would have written, I believe, his response. Moshe Feinstein was a great scholar. Lubavitcher Rebbe, he wrote letters. But more than that, people like Kafidamis for Bregans, translated into English, when he spoke like at large gatherings. He really didn't write, per se, any classic works, Lubavitcher Rebbe. So, in any event, there came a point Rabbi Soloveitchik did write. Or at least things began to be published. It's just its own story. I don't know why and when he decided to do that. There are now huge amounts of, I can show you, probably 6-7 volumes of Hebrew now. And by the way, we're not looking at anything in Hebrew. For those who know Hebrew, I can give you sources to look at. We're just looking at English sources. I think there's enough to look at to give us the ideas behind it. And many things he did originally were in Yiddish. We had to change that. We have to understand, he knew Hebrew, he knew Yiddish, he learned English, and wait to see his English. I mean, for a guy who didn't know English, let's say he was 30 years old. And he studied Aristotle in Greek, and he studied Latin thinkers in Latin, Roman things in Latin. He studied everyone their original language, which again, Rav Kook never did. We're talking about a really unique individual in terms of his involvement, we'll see, in the secular world. The Talmudic and Halachic expositor Soloveitchik had an unusual facility for explaining difficult technical problems. He also was an orator of his native Yiddish as well as English and Hebrew. The annual Halachic Megadic Discourse, which he delivered at Yeshiva University on the anniversary of his father's death, was said, he said all that, fine, published very little because of perfectionism and other reasons. Okay, stop there, that's all we need for now. Okay. I should say one more thing about Rabbi Soloveitchik. He's highly complex, not just because of the different things he's involved in and differentiating him from other thinkers and other Talmudic scholars, but it was well known that Rabbi Soloveitchik, as I told you, would think something through once, give a whole lecture on it, and guess what? 2 years later, flip-flops. That's how his mind works. He didn't consider it an inconsistency. He considered that to be fresh. He considered that to be always reevaluating. You know, like sometimes a guy gives a good sermon, then he goes around the country and gets the same sermon. It's good, right? It's done. I see it. It's responded to well. He never did that. He didn't repeat things. He went through all the material again every time. And that means he could come up with different answers. Now, that's why you have a huge debate in the Orthodox world today. Now, this guy from Rabbi Soloveitchik said this. This guy from Rabbi Soloveitchik said that. It's funny, I was in New York doing a wedding this last week, and I sat down with, I told one of my mentors, Rabbi Parnas, also a great guy. My wife is there with me, and I asked him, how do you resolve this? He says, I think Rabbi Soloveitchik said both. I think that this guy might have asked him at one time, and he thought through, and everything came up with this, and then he reevaluated him with this. I think he said both, because that's how his mind works. And he'd walk in and say something, he'd say something like, again, a year later, he'd say, but you said last year that the concept was this. He'd say, you're right, and I reevaluated it. And again, he would try to develop every theory to the utmost so that it'd be so pristine when you were done, and, you know, everything would seem to make sense, one way or the other. I mean, this is well known. Again, it's still a huge debate. Now, I must tell you this as well. And we'll see this again toward the end of the class, maybe the last session. And it's something that bothers me terribly. I don't know how to respond to it. When Rabbi Soloveitchik was at Yeshiva University, especially, I'll say, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it's like, you know, there's a famous story they tell, it's like a joke. They say that Look Magazine, you heard me say this before, maybe. Look Magazine once had an article called The Vanishing Orthodox Jew. Well, here we are today. Look Magazine is gone, but the Orthodox Jew is gone. Right? Now, people thought at that time that with Rabbi Soloveitchik there and this vision of yeshiva, university, in one place, right? That this is going to be the way Orthodoxy is going to go for the future. I mean, you have Rabbi Soloveitchik, this genius in philosophy, this genius in Talmud. I mean, this is like the man everyone looks up to, and this is the way Orthodoxy is going to go. And I got to tell you, it really, in a sense, hasn't gone that way. Because as Irving Greenberg said, that the battle in traditional circles, certainly beyond traditional circles, but he said, will be won by baby carriages. And among other things, when modern Orthodox families are having, who knows, an average still of only 3 kids, you go into so-called yeshivish circles. Even in this town, I can point it out. And certainly in Hasidic circles. In yeshivish circles in this town, people are having more like 8 kids. I mean, sometimes people can have kids. But let's say a help could have 8 kids, 9 kids. Hasidic circles are having 12, 13 kids. Now, you know, if you add that up a few generations, guess what? It's incredible. It's unbelievable. Now, so that's one, I guess, reason why Rabbi Soloveitchik's Orthodoxy has not kind of won the day, and it hasn't won the day. You go to the Borough Park, go to Brooklyn, you'll see it hasn't won the day. Not that there aren't bastions of modern Orthodoxy, too. Go to Teaneck, New York, you'll see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of so-called modern Orthodoxies. But yet, everyone kind of felt at the time that how could you not become a so-called modern Orthodox Jew? Now, a lot of us don't even like that phrase, but that's what we call centrist Orthodoxy, but that depends where you're standing, you know, who's in the center, what's there in the center, compared to who. But this modern Orthodoxy, people thought, like, this is the wave of the future. Who could deny this? You can be great in secular studies. You can be great in Torah studies. You can be Rabbi Soloveitchik, like the hero here. The man we're all striving to be. The Maimonides of our time, someone might say, right? But it hasn't necessarily gone that way. Interesting. In fact, it's kind of going the other way. Certainly in Israel, modern Orthodoxy, is a small thing. I mean, you know, compared to the way you have growth in the other parties, the other Hasidic dynasties and things like that. But in any event, we'll get to this at the end of the sessions that we hit the last week, and we kind of discuss the legacy of Rabbi Soloveitchik and kind of what's happened. Okay. Let's turn the page 5. You have your biography for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Whatever else you can keep reading would be helpful. So here you have a philosophical essay by Albert Camus. Why am I bringing in Camus? And then you'll see on the next few pages, you have things I've just taken again because I can't present all of their writings. You have things by Camus, Jaspers. These are from the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which I happen to have. Then we're going to go into Kierkegaard a little here. Now, I thought this was a class in Soul of Ancients, so why are we doing this? Because as I said, I have to be careful how I say this. Let me put it this way. When Rabbi Soloveitchik went to Berlin, as a Nancy, I know what you would say. Watch how I'm going to try to avoid what you would say. Now, if I tell you that if you read through Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, you will see that, and we'll see in a moment, that the minute he opens up, you're introduced to Descartes, and Karl Barth, and Niebuhr, and Kierkegaard, and Aquinas, and I mean, essential thinkers especially. You'll be shocked. I mean, you'll see when we get to secular studies thinking, you'll see, it's incredible what this guy did in Berlin, what he read in Berlin. Now, I'm sure the common approach would be that Rabbi Soloveitchik went to Berlin, and it's clear that in Berlin he was influenced by what was, and we're going to look at this a little bit, the philosophy of existentialism, which was the philosophy of the time, which was writing on a way, very intense way. That was the philosophy, existentialism. If you don't know what it is, we'll just get some ideas in a few moments, in a very bare-bones treatment of it that I'm going to give you. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's there. He's influenced, you see, right and left. He quotes these guys, you know. The only thing I would say is, was he influenced? I'm just arguing logically here. I know some would say, of course he was influenced. That's what they're talking about. A man goes, it's a wave, they are taking over, you know, Germany, whatever, and he just gets caught up in it. Or could it be, though, that Rabbi Soloveitchik actually had these ideas on his own? We're talking about a genius here, I'm talking about you and me. And basically he saw that existentialism seems to express the very ideas that he felt about Judaism. That's something that has to be considered. Like Maimonides. Like Maimonides, you know, was influenced by Aristotelianism, but to what degree? He certainly was, but I mean, or was Maimonides basically kind of saw the Torah and Halakha as a rational type of system, whatever, and so Aristotelianism kind of expressed well what he felt anyway about it, as opposed to it like he felt otherwise, and here comes his philosophy and kind of just changes the man. Are you following the subtle difference? And I'm not sure which is correct. I would imagine most scholars would say he went to Berlin and boom, you know, this thing had an impact on him. I'm just saying, I don't know. I bet if he were here alive, he would certainly slap someone who said that. Never like to be told like how he was influenced by psychological factors. Someone once wrote an article about him and said, oh, Soloveitchik was really this, but he strove to be this. And I remember that like, he walked in, you know, like he was furious, you know, trying to sum me up as if you know anything about what's inside of me. But Rabbi Soloveitchik, there's no doubt, utilizes the existentialist to go ahead and express what he feels is meaningful about Judaism. And this is going to be critical. And I would say it's almost not fair to read Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy. And by the way, we are reading his philosophy, or we're not reading his halakhic writings. He has halakhic writings based on his lectures that are now just coming out. I've got 8 volumes already. We're not looking at his halakhic decision-making process. We're looking at his philosophy. Many times you've heard me in class come out and quote Rabbi Soloveitchik. It has nothing to do with his philosophy. Okay? We're looking at his philosophical writings, which are greatly expressed in existentialism. Unless people here have studied existentialism, even religious existentialism, which I have been lucky to have done in Columbia University, then you're kind of going to be behind. That's okay, I study it, I'm still behind. Okay? I mean, this is difficult stuff. But I'm going to try to give you some basics so we can go ahead and understand basically where Rabbi Soloveitchik is coming from. In the philosophy, you're going to see this again and again in his writings. So if you look here at source number 5, I'm going to read this week, next week, then we'll go around. Camus, and this is the myth of Sisyphus. You ever hear of this, the myth of Sisyphus?
Yeah.
I got it edited and excerpted off the internet because it was too long, the whole thing. I won't read it all. Suffice to say that Sisyphus was punished by the gods for interfering in some of their activities. It's kind of common in Greek myths, as you know. Someone's being punished. So Sisyphus is punished by having in the underworld to go ahead and to roll this huge rock up this hill, this mountain, for eternity. So if he gets to the mountain, he pushes up the rock, he's exhausted, only to have the rock then fall down again to the bottom of the mountain. And he has to walk down and do it again. Doesn't seem like a very thrilling existence. What does Camus do with this? Sisyphus ceased rolling a rock to the top of a mountain. Hence the stone would fall back of its own weight. There is no more dreadful punishment than futile and hopeless labor. This is the price that must be paid for the passions of this earth. Sisyphus watches the stone rush down in a few moments toward that lower world, whence he will have to push it up again toward the summit. He goes back down to the plain. It is during that return, that pause, that Sisyphus interests me. I see that man going back down with a heavy yet measured step toward the torment of which he will never know the end. That hour, like a breathing space which returns as surely as his suffering, that is the hour of consciousness. At each of these moments when he leaves the heights and he is superior to his fate, he is stronger than the rock. If this myth is tragic, that is because its hero is conscious. Where would his torture be, indeed, if at every step the hope of succeeding of help? The lucidity that was to constitute his torture at the same time crowns his victory. There is no fate that cannot be surmounted by scorn. All Sisyphus's silent joy is contained therein. His fate belongs to him. I leave Sisyphus at the foot of the mountain. Sisyphus teaches the higher fidelity that negates the gods and raises rocks. The struggle itself toward the heights is enough to fill the heart. One finds one's burden. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. I tell you, for years I had no idea what he was talking about. I think I have some idea, but not some idea. Wow. Does anyone suggest some notions here of maybe what he's trying to say? Yeah.
Well, the virtue is in the process of the endeavor, not in the result. I mean, you know, if you could really go and nail the aesthetic tour, you'll never get there. And maybe that's what happened to Soul of Egypt, where every time he reinterpreted, the rock fell down again.
Wow, you got all thought out. Very good. But you're right, I didn't carry over the tour. You're right, though. Certainly, just one thing at a time, the struggle. You're right. The struggle, knowing what I'm doing, I'm pushing this rock, right? But I'm in control, as it were, even though you think the fate is decreed against him. But it's kind of saying the fate is on you, but you take it in your own hands. You do it in those breaks, in the struggle, when you're going down the hill. You know, you have moments of pause to consider. But basically, he says, you're right, the struggle is what is prominent. But what's the struggle? What kind of struggle is it? Just one more element we have to put here. Maybe two more elements that can you emphasize. What kind of struggle? What would you call this thing? What would you, taking a rock, pushing, what would you call it? Camus calls it absurd. I mean, it's an absurd situation. And Camus and the existentialists consider life to be somewhat absurd. It would be an incredible struggle. A struggle for something you may never reach. And moreover, it's a lonely struggle. Here, this guy is all alone, Sisyphus. It's not like his family's there with him to bring him water or something. He is all by himself. This is a lonely struggle. The extensive to read, so I just want to give you a little something from the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is a great work to have, by the way. The four-volume work, it's really eight-volume four. Just underline a few things here. There's this isolation of man, I have it underlined, right?
Yeah.
As an evaluative and purpose of being in a world that affords no support, such attitudes that Camus calls the absurdity of the human condition. Sisyphus is us. We live in an absurd world. Go to the next line, where I have another line. Only by going on living in the face of their own absurdity can human beings achieve their full stature. There's an absurdity, we're all thrust into certain situations, certain things we don't like about life that are overcoming us. Somehow the only way to succeed is to go ahead and to live with it, to face up to it, to deal with it. Now, by the way, right off, can you kind of say to yourself, what's he talking about? Does everyone feel that here? We all live in absurdity. Just keep that in mind, because it'll be important for Rabbi Soloveitchik as well. Go to the next page. I don't know if you ever heard of Carl Jaspers, also a great influence in existentialism. He's quoted often by Rabbi Soloveitchik. About five lines down here. Genuine philosophy arises directly out of the problems confronting the individual philosopher in his existential or historical situation. General problems are mere derivatives. philosophy need not be metaphysics. It can only illuminate some of the potentialities of individual existence, an existence that is ineffable, unique, and free. Their thinking, next line, welled up directly from their personal existence, and because they illustrated the axiom that philosophical thinking begins in the attempt to communicate to another the nature of one's existence. I'm going to explain this in a second. Go over to the right, epistemology. Jasper's method is generally skeptical. It consists of the exploration, description, and analysis of first-person experiences. These form the basic data for philosophical generalizations and are for any person the sole source of his information about reality. You hear what he's saying? This is what he's saying. Hegel and all great philosophers before him always emphasized kind of general notions to the exclusion of the I or the specific thing. When I had a philosophy professor at Columbia, he put it like this. Like most philosophers, if they were talking about a chair, they're talking about a chair. When you think of a chair, what do you think of? You think of whatever, three legs, four legs. You think of a back, you think of a seat. So they were saying, not a chair. This chair. Red. Metal. This chair. Not a chair. In other words, these existentialists wanted the emphasis not put on humanity, human beings, general problems, but the notion that there's an I here, there's a me, who has my own unique experience, which I have to understand and come to grips to, and that is the source of my understanding of the world. Here, my philosophy professor put it like this. He said, I remember he said, it's like, you have a quarterback in a football game. Now, you know, we sit in the stands, we think we know what's going on, you know? We see the replays, we watch everything else, you know, rah-rah, we see what's happening, we see what he did wrong. To the quarterback, you can't understand, you can't understand. I'm here, I'm in the game, okay? I knew this guy was coming on me, don't tell me what you saw. I'm right here, I'm playing the game, I'm right here experiencing it. You're just in a total spectrum. To the existentialists, the greatest truth is what they themselves experience. The emphasis on their I-ness, on their own unique experience. Truth, they said, is subjectivism. We think truth is being objective, standing back, looking at it from all. They believe that subjectivity was important in understanding truth for me. Goes on a little. My thinking begins with and ends with subjectivity, since awareness, as Kant saw, always consists partially of interpretations. He even says, go down to the next underlying part, there is no certainty either in philosophy or in science. I am forced to depend ultimately on the intuitions and decisions of my own ego. I mean, that's not to say they discredited science, but they believe highly in their own individual experience. Go down to psychology, four or five lines down. Yield says, Exister and Schulung yield access to the questioner himself. Ordinary modes of perception and cognition, which apply a subject apprehending an object, always bypass the real self. The real and valuable, that is, the authentic in man, is called existence. Existence, the genuine self, is not objective and unique. It is infinitely open to new possibilities and inaccessible to traditional philosophical investigations. Next page. He describes some more. He says, it is finally the experience of loneliness that cries in the wilderness. Because if it's you, it's subjective, you're all alone. Go down to the next line, because all this is Rabbi Soloveitchik. Man is alienated from his world. He comes from a dim past and goes into an indefinite future. Life is a flux in which he seeks anchor. Existence is rich in mysterious paradoxes and antinomies. Wait till you see this in Rabbi Soloveitchik. I mean, this is right out of it. Such as those of freedom coexisting with dependence, communication with solitude, good with evil, truth with falsehood, happiness with grief, life with death, and progress with destruction. These contradictions, Rabbi Soloveitchik, like you... I'm going crazy reading this stuff. Like, it's just straight passion, contradiction, and this, and the fight exists, and this against this. It's incredible. This is him, like, all the way. You'll see it. The right paragraph on the bottom on the right side. But in the end, human existence is a failure. There is no escape from man's limits, the limit of death in particular. Yet man is condemned to endless striving. Again, does everyone feel this way? See, I mean, I'm just pointing this out. Does everyone feel everything's absurd? Everything is contradiction. Everything is overwhelming. Everything is, you know, fear.
Like,
I'm alone. Does everyone feel that way? So I just want to point out one thing to number one. Look at, now this is a commentary by the professor David Swenson. I don't know who he is, but I have his translation of Kierkegaard. And his interesting comment at the beginning, he says, he's commenting on vis-a-vis Kierkegaard. Most writers on the philosophy of religion display no inkling of the existence of such a conflict. That's what I'm asking you. Do you feel such conflict? What conflict? And much less do they reveal any sympathetic apprehension of its significance. Most people don't even know. I would say, what's Rabbi Soloveitchik talking about? If you'd ask for Moshe Feinstein, maybe. Yes, I mean, what's he talking about? What contradictions? We're going to see Rabbi Soloveitchik and see if that's true. I'm telling you. Their descriptions of spiritual attitudes are much like those naive paintings which depict the landscape in general, fitting everything and nothing. To describe religion as devotion to an ideal, without distinguishing inter, and without expending a single word upon the all-important question of the how of this devotion, is about as illuminating as to describe iron as a physical element. For those whose religious experience has been concrete enough to need a more precise intellectual orientation, Kierkegaard offers a rich and concrete psychology of the very aspects of the life of the spirit, and his categories are sharp enough to find to satisfy the intellectually ambitious. You can apply this exactly to Rabbi Soloveitchik. That's exactly what you see he does. He's trying to reach down into the spiritual activity, the spiritual movement in a person, and try to define it and explain it to people. I see many people, like he's saying here, my friend, who needs to explain it? You dabble. You do a mitzvah. What's the way? Who needs explanations of what's going on inside you? Who needs it? So Kierkegaard thought he needed it in the world of faith. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, you'll see, thinks you need it as well. Does someone have any other questions?
How do you ever get any meeting of the minds to solve anything if everybody perceives things specifically according to their eyeness?
All I saw was, it's a good question, all I saw is that, I forgot if it was Kierkegaard or one of the other seven, that when different egos go ahead and discuss things and they see they have similar feelings about things, so then you can have some type of agreement. That's what he says. That's a good question. Sure, everything depends on my view of it. Yeah. They ever come together from it. But that's what he says. Yeah.
These people weren't big on the God thing.
People like Sargon. On God? No, well, Kierkegaard was. Kierkegaard was a religious man. Kierkegaard wrote Fear and Trembling about Abraham, the great man of faith. You will see, again, Rabbi Soloveitchik either has, as I said, similar thoughts or is directly influenced by Kierkegaard all the way. When he discusses Abraham and Jacob and the Rosalmatics there all the way. Kierkegaard wrote on Christianity, Kierkegaard was a big believer.
What about
Camus? I don't know about. I don't know about Camus, but others were Karl Barth, others were. Many of these were religious existentialists. He was writing this book for that solitary individual. This is what he's writing this book here in Tremblay for. The solitary individual. Because again, that's what he's aiming to emphasize. He means the individual separated from the rest. The individual as he would be if he were solitary and alone, face to face with his destiny, with his vocation, with the eternal, with God himself who had singled him out. Perhaps Descartes was on the right road when he sought to isolate the individual I, the man, and all the experience and make it the starting point for his system. But he was wrong and even culpable in not pressing on in his explanation of the I beyond capacity to think. For thought, Kierkegaard would insist, is not the most unique endowment. Here is the core of the I. Here, in the core of the eye, it's a center from which choice springs, from which responsibility for one's acts springs, from which the ultimate sense of uneasiness and weariness with anything that is short of the highest of all in reality ultimately issues, from which remorse and repentance arise. Go on to page, next page, and I got to turn a little bit. What is the next page? 11? Actually, the bottom of the last page. He goes on to say, find the next page, men have committed supreme treason. Right, go down to, where I have it underlined, only when man is alone can he face the eternal. See that? Only when man is alone can he face the eternal. Let me say something incredible about Rabbi Soloveitchik. You all know in a traditional synagogue, right, Orthodox synagogue, you have to have a machitza, right? You know why you have to have a machitza? Why do you have to have machitza? Huh? Men and women, right? Every men and women. You know, I have to remember Soloveitchik on a tape he gave some lecture at the University of East. You know, he says, I have to have machitza? Just like Kierkegaard says, because if you face God, you have to be alone. You can't be with your family. You can't be sitting with your wife. You've got to be alone. You've got to face God by yourself. That's the purpose of machitza. You know what else he says there? There's a famous Shulchan Aruch halacha in Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, that says you're not allowed to kiss your children. It says actually your young children, young little cute children and grandchildren. You can't kiss them in synagogue. Because as it were, I'm just telling you what the law says, it says it's as if you're showing, you know, you kiss right in front of God, you kiss your children inappropriately. It's inappropriate. That's what it says. You know what Rabbi Soloveitchik says? Again, you know why? You're just supposed to feel alone. When you hug, you kiss your kids, family, nidana, mechitza. Even your own, he said his custom, he didn't sit with his father sometimes because he's supposed to feel alone. Now, you could argue, if that's the case, why do you have communal prayer? God by himself.
Yeah, right.
So actually, I thought about that. If you look at Maimonides in his Mishnah Torah, he says, and Rabbi Soloveitchik says this in one place as well, that really communal prayer was somewhat of a compromise. If you look at Maimonides, he says people used to pray all alone. But what happened? People did not pray. They had to put it down into writing. They had to go ahead and come together and have, let's say, it wasn't all writing for the printing press, because they had to have one person lead the services and others just say amen, right, to fulfill their obligation, because people do not pray. So people had to come together because of the exile from Israel to Babylonian center. My mom, he said that. So it's almost like it was a compromise. And then once it happened, it became, you know, the structure of Jewish tradition to daven as a congregation. But originally it wasn't that way, right? So originally you faced them alone. One of the great episodes for Rabbi Soloveitchik is Abraham and Isaac. Well, think about it, just like for Kierkegaard. Abraham's all alone. Didn't even tell Sarah about it. Just him and God. God says, go and kill your son Isaac. You think he talked to someone about it? You think maybe he'd ask Sarah about it? He took all his advisors in something, you know? Didn't tell anyone. It's just him and God. That's it. And that's his great night of faith for Kierkegaard. This absurd situation, go kill my son. And just me and you, God. Some say you can tell Isaac about it, right? Some say Isaac knew, some say he didn't. This is it. This is, now what's so great about this? What's so great about it? So go down, again, left side, about 10 lines up. He must act, he must choose, he must risk, he must make the leap. For in an existence where qualitative differences remain, there is no other entry into the deepest level of existential living as an individual. Only by this leap of faith could one know the release of guilt, the sense of commitment, the acceptance of a vocation, of a calling whose service is perfect freedom. Down below, the consciousness of one's eternal responsibility to be an individual. When you make that decision, it's you and God. What do you mean? I decided, well, I went to ask some other people, we discussed it, I decided to do it. That's courage, that's making a decision, that's confronting God. Confronting God is you recognize who you are, you take responsibility, you go and you step forward, you do it. But that's a solitary statement. That's not like, what are you guys doing? You guys gonna do it? That's what he means. That is that heroic? Is that something great? Is that the religious mind? Is that the person going, want to do it? Yeah, let's go. That's not it. What's all about is the man taking responsibility for himself, all alone, and going ahead and making a decision. It's an interesting question, because, of course, as we all know, that in the halachic universe, you have to ask a sheila, you have to ask a question. I would say there the problem is, perhaps, you don't have the knowledge. In other words, I'm presuming the existentialists think that for an intelligent person, whatever, knowing his reality, you know, I guess that he can make the decision. A problem we have to have halakhic issues because I don't know it. I'm ignorant. I can't make a decision, but I don't know what the facts are. But it's certainly a tension. You're right. It's certainly a tension.
No, once you have a decision, you still have your own decision that you follow.
Okay. But here initially it would seem like Kierkegaard saying it's all up to the people to go ahead and to do it on his own. Hegel tended always to make on the right side there an individual a mere passing point, a moment in the cosmic process, and to insist on the individual gaining his concrete ethical significance through being identified with the social, religious, and political institutions of his time. Man is to be saved by identification with a set of external arrangements. This for Kierkegaard is the ultimate blasphemy. For instead of heightening his core of responsibility and integrity, man is invited to do what he is already enamored with doing. To join the crowd. Man, I think it's all into the organic whole. I hear this. This I hear. This is it. At the bottom here on the right where it starts. The real problem, which he tried to bring back, which was the awakening of the individual. This is what all philosophy lacked. Kierkegaard and other existentialists felt and what they wanted to bring back. And again, you'll see it again in Rabbi Soloveitchik, the emphasis on the individual again and again. Turn to the next page. We'll finish up here in a minute or two. Now, you should read all this if you can, but I guess that's the main thing. Before the quiet days, the eternal, there is no hiding place. As individuals, we are what we are before God, and no mass opinion reflects this in the least. Again, how do you face up to God by saying, here I am, I'm not going on anyone else's shoulders, I'm not hiding here, I face up to God directly. Next page. And he says, the root of equality is therefore grounded in the unchanging personal relation between the individual and God. And look at this is very interesting, going down a few lines. There is nothing in Holy Scripture, he points out, this is Kierkegaard, about loving man in the mass, only about loving your neighbor as yourself. In other words, to the individual. To them, you separate him out of the abstract mass or public, and he becomes an individual. And when you love him as yourself, you testify to that deep equality of all men as individuals before God. Is that beautiful? This would be a great sermon. He says, why do you say love your neighbor as yourself? Why not love your neighbors? Why not love the community as yourself? Because that's not the point. The point is not to lose track of the individual. Love your neighbor as yourself means that I see this person as an individual, because that way is what is essential, as he's saying, to a person being a person, to a person being an individual. And then we recognize everyone as an individual, and that self-importance is critical, Kierkegaard says. Finally, he says, page 14, his vocation, his calling is not your calling. Everyone has a different calling. Or Soloveitchik has a whole thing in Hebrew about this as well. Everyone has their own way to go. Everyone goes to their own drug. No one could be more faithful than Kierkegaard in pointing out that everyone has a different vocation, a different calling. But do you know what is your calling? What is your vocation? And have you accepted it? That's the great burden of, the Sisyphus and the rock, okay? You got your rock. Everyone's dealt out something, all right? You recognize it. Are you dealing with it? Or are you just ignoring it? Are you just walking away from it? Are you in the struggle? Are you trying to go ahead and climb the mountain? So that basically is what the existentialists push, and you will see it, as I said, from Salvation over and over. And while we didn't read him today, I again say, because it wouldn't have been fair, I believe, to read him without knowing where he's coming from. You would read him and say, where'd you get this? What's he talking about? Where'd you get this idea from? So now you saw some existentialist philosophy. I'll take
given your limited and somewhat indirect exposure to Rabbi Soloveitchik, how did he come to have such a profound influence
on me? I would say because the way I have come is in such a way that I, first of all, being very heavily influenced by Maimonides. Maimonides says, "Kabel et ha'emet mi she'amro," you should accept the truth from whoever says it. So I'm a belief that there's the truth of the Torah and there's the truth of reason. My mommy's goal was to try to harmonize those, right? And that's why, in a sense, he was my hero. With Soloveitchik, as we will see in the last class, that really was not his goal, but nonetheless, he recognized the truths of the philosophy of his day, which was existentialism. Now, whether I personally believe in the existentialist split and chaos and all this stuff going on, like he does, in a sense, really didn't matter to me. What mattered was that he recognized that there are other sources of truth beyond the Torah that can yet be found in the Torah. In other words, we'll see that his whole engagement in his writings is to try to show that all this existential stuff is all in the Torah already. He'll quote it from the Talmud, right and left, from Halacha. He'll show you it's all there. And to me, that's what Maimonides did too. His goal was to show that I can show you Aristotle's right there in the Torah. There's no need to get upset. In today's world, orthodoxy is kind of on a roof. We don't need anything else. You have the Torah. Why would you sit down and waste time on existentialists? Why would Rabbi Soloveitchik sit and waste time in Berlin studying Barth and Kierkegaard and all these guys? And wait till I show you the list of people he studied from his work, The Halachic Mind, which I don't know if anyone can understand this work. Very difficult. You would think he sat there for 50 years in Britain. You'd think, how did he ever know anything in the Torah? But because he believed that these thoughts were reflections of truth as well. So I don't know why. My makeup is such that I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem when I read Descartes, I read Aristotle, or read someone to say, hey, he's saying something truthful, and if it's the Torah, and he said it in a very nice way, etc. I have people, if I quote sometimes in shul, a poet, they'll say, why do you have to quote a poet? You couldn't quote Rashi. Even though I quoted already 10 different Talmudic sources. sermon, someone come up and say, like I once quoted, some of you heard me say this once, a beautiful poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, the Renaissance. The lady comes up and she says, why can't the quote Edna St. Vincent Millay? I said, because she said it's so true, right? What, it has to be Rashi who says it true? She said it true also. She said to me that's incredibly appealing. And yet, I'm already passionate when I teach anything, but this is just something that just affects me. And I thank you for the opportunity to teach it, because for years, I really wanted to crystallize my thought around the cultivation, bring it together, and I'm really evaluating where I am, and that will give me the opportunity to see you next week.